Yeah, I went back and I listened to each of our firsts. So like I listened to the first one Tim and I did, and the first one Paul, you did, and the first one Rosie did. And it's just so fun. I mean, it was just like I mean, Tim, we started this in 2018. Like that was July of 2018. That was 6 years ago, which is insane.
Let's take a minute. I mean, I've already got us recording here on our 300th episode. Who wants to share like a highlight from your perspective on the first 300 episodes?
I went through and I was thinking about some of these moments, and it's funny how so many of them. Hello, oh, you're, this is a nice one right here. Hello, cat. So many of them were about like stuff that was happening both on the podcast and off the podcast. So you know, the first couple of years of Tim and I just trying to figure out what in the world we were doing. And you know, I just remember in those early days when we had so many experts on or so many guests on. Every time I would email someone, just cold call email someone and say, you know, this is what we're doing. Would you like to be a part of it? People were like, yes, absolutely. I kept expecting very important scholars to be like, I don't have time for this. Like, no. And almost to a person, they were like, yeah, this sounds like definitely something I'd love to do. So that was kind of wonderful seeing how many people really are excited about taking these insights from the academy and making them relevant to a wider practical audience. And then fast forward from that to when we were recording our Trinity Days Advent episodes at Trinity Lutheran Seminary.
Oh, yeah.
And I had all these students who'd taken my Hebrew class. And so they knew Tim McNinch from Blackboard Hebrew videos. And they were just like, I watched them almost walk up to him with like, can I have your autograph? I mean, it wasn't quite there, but they were very much like, you're Tim McNinch. Like, super excited to meet you.
I did feel like a celebrity for about 10
you,
minutes.
Right, you are. You still are. You still totally
You
are.
truly are. Yeah. Well, I wanted to share you know the you know I had been a secret listener of First Reading Podcast for a while before Tim approached me and said we would like for you to join. And you know, I remember one of the episodes that I really was impressed by was, I think it was Tim and Rosie. It was some parts of Rosie's dissertation on Esther. That was like one of the episodes that I was really impressed by. I was like, wow, these people are doing amazing work, like, you know, compressing all of these like condensed, you know, scholarly material and, you know, representing them in very simple ways for people to like follow and, you know, giving some preaching insights. That's amazing, you know. One day, Tim approached me and said, would you like to join? I'm like, of course, come on.
I think for me, as I was trying to answer this question of like what stood out, it was really hard because like, yeah, I looked at some of those early episodes and, you know, saw like Gail Yee and Mary Jorsted and like Ashley Wilcox. And I was like, oh, I could pick any of these. But then I was thinking that isn't really what I, you know, I'm like why I look forward to, you know, doing these with you. Like it's been the like unfolding revelation through our relationships, right? That I think like one thing that we, I don't know if we say explicitly, is that these texts create and support relationships, especially like
Did
over
you?
time. And to me, that's been a real richness, right? I mean, I'm talking to scholars, so I mean, you all are experts. And I've watched us own our expertise over the years, you know, which is another really wonderful thing. But it's like I find the surprise of our recordings to be one of the most exciting things about the conversation. It's like we have prepped, you know, each of us have prepped from our own kind of angle, but inevitably in the conversation, something new emerges. And I find that to be just such a gift of how these stories continue to curate deep conversations and connections. And that's, I was like, and I don't even know how to name that other than to say like what a joy that is. And like that's my favorite thing. You know, like every episode is a little bit of a surprise.
You know, on that theme, I would add, I have a by now it's a vague memory of sitting at a picnic table with Rachel where she was pitching me this idea of, you know, there's just not something out there to help people preach from the Old Testament and feel comfortable with that and have some like hope. And you and I were like, you were in your second year. I was in my first year at Emory. And it was just like, we're learning all this amazing stuff. And I wish there was a way to get this out to like preachers, like a podcast or something. And I said, I sort of know how to do that type of thing. I could, give you a microphone and let you do your thing. But you know, this really was Rachel's vision to do this podcast. And the thing that these 6.5 or whatever years later, still stands out to me. We all know that being a biblical scholar can be a kind of lonely or at least somewhat isolated endeavor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of time spent on your own with books and whatnot. And what Rachel invited me into in doing this podcast was an intentionally collaborative approach to scholarship.
For
me has really, I feel like this experience has kind of shaped my whole like approach to being a biblical scholar, of doing it in conversation and in relationship with others, like you three. And I think that's a good thing. And I think shows a sort of different kind of model of what it looks like to be a fancy schmancy scholar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like you're giving me a little more credit than I deserve there, Tim, because I was like, I have this idea. And you're like, I can make this idea actually work in real life. So I think it was a joint vision. But yeah, I agree. The ability to do scholarship in community, the way like probably the Bible is written. I mean, how many times have I said to my students, like, the Bible is written by committee, right? And yet we as scholars pretend to be like individuals doing the work.
That's
so
right.
Yeah, no, it's just a huge joy to get to do it collaboratively and be formed by my conversation, our conversations together. So
here we are, 300 episodes. This is episode number 300, if we've counted correctly, which you never know. But it really is a joy to be doing this with you all. And I think we should give our preacher, listener, watchers something for this 300th episode beyond just our reminiscing and celebrating each other here. So what do we have on the docket here?
Well, we should probably introduce, like, this is our November 24th. This is the Reign of Christ or Christ the King Sunday, depending on which tradition you're in. Depending on what we have prepped, it could be 2 Samuel 23, 1 through 7, or Psalm 132, 1 through 12. Or Daniel 7, 9 through 12, 13 to 14, or Psalm 93. Rosie's here, so I'm sure we're going to bring John 18 into the conversation. And maybe somebody picked up Revelation. Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows?
So before you jump in there, I think I just remembered this. We should say, welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament Lectionary Podcast.
Oh, my God.
I'm Reverend Dr. Tim McNinch.
Yes, you are.
Oh my God. He was
ordained as a Presbyterian minister a week ago.
Yes. So,
another little celebration here.
Congrats.
And I teach at Christian Theological Seminary. Who are you guys?
I'm Rosie Candlethal, assistant professor in religious studies at Wake Forest University.
I'm Paul Essa. I am a PhD student in Hebrew Bible at Yale University.
And I'm Rachel Wren. Reverend, what's my name? Who am I? Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren. Assistant professor of biblical studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University.
With that just totally polished intro, then.
Nailed it.
Welcome to Christ the King Sunday. I'm simple-minded, so I just picked the first text that came up in the list because I thought first reading, I'll just read the first thing, right?
Right.
So I took a look at 2 Samuel 23. Here we have what is titled as The Last Words of David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Intriguing. Near the end of 2 Samuel. These are not actually the last words of David. So
that's pretty good. Spoiler alert, man. Spoiler alert.
David's story continues on into 1 Kings and then the whole thing with the census and all of that at the end of 2 Samuel here. So these last words of David are a little ahead of schedule, but it is interesting that near the end of the books of Samuel comes a couple of these poems or songs. They're in verse, right? They're poetry. So we have a long one that comes right before the lectionary reading. And then the last words of David, quote unquote, are also in poetry, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. And to me, I was thinking, you know, that reminds me, I spent a lot of time at the beginning of 1 Samuel. Mm-hmm. And so we have Hannah's song in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel. And then this poem is a kind of bookend in a way to the legacy of David in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel. And there's similar themes. I mean, Hannah's song has a kind of splitting of the world into those for and against and a kind of turning upside down of the expectations, and then concludes with a blessing on God's anointed, the king. And then here at the end, the other bookend here, we have a kind of reflection on monarchy, a kind of definitive reflection on monarchy from the OG king, David, right? So I sort of saw it as functioning in kind of a framing way like that.
Yeah. I got stuck on just the first words. These are the last words of David. So I listeners might not know, but I'm dealing with some end of life issues with family. So that kind of stuck out to me about last words on Christ the King Sunday, because John 18 is also, you know, Jesus's in some ways last conversations with Pilate. So, you know, it made me think about, just on a larger scale, like what our last words might be and the consciousness that it takes to maybe utter those, and what, like Tim, as you were saying, these are not literally David's last words, but they've been put on his lips at a moment, you know, where people would pay attention. Whenever we hear last words, right, we think there's something really important to communicate, something that if we're left with only a few moments, this is what we would say, right? And so my ear perks up. I want to hear what's being said next, right? And the way that it be the oracle of David, son of Jesse, the oracle of a man whom God exalted, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the favorite of the strong one of Israel. All that kind of, you know, history rehashing, remembering, you know, that just, it moved me to think about what might last words look like, and particularly maybe from, I don't know, someone that you look up to.
I was thinking more along the lines of the actual identity of the king, the monarch that has been described here. Like there's a big emphasis on like one who rules justly and one who rules in the fear of God. And it's likened to like the bright morning sun that comes after rain, you know. And the first thing I wrote in my note is like, was anyone like that? Was any of Israel's kings like that? Like, you know, the kind of sharp contrast between, you know, the list of kings that we read about in First and Second Kings and maybe some parts of Chronicles and all the things that they did that did not please God. Maybe David was a great king, but also it depends on how you read, right? So is it pointing to a king that is here, or is it pointing to a king somewhere else that is yet to come? Is it like, you know, resonating with some ideals of idealism? Right. And I guess that's the thought that I had. But like beyond everything, it's a beautiful imagery in that, you know, just kingship or ruling justly is it brings flourishing. And this flourishing is likened to like the kind of flourishing that we all experience when you experience bright sunlight after rain. Like we all know that, like, the life of plants and the life of human beings is not just rain. We just don't need rain. We just don't need sun. We need a combination of both, right? And so the imagery is just amazing. It's beautiful. But then again, the question of, well, this is probably pointing to something else. This is probably a lot more idealistic than descriptive of something that Israel has experienced so far.
Paul and Rosie, you're both making me think. I had totally missed the last words piece. I mean, I kind of just like quickly glossed over it, but Rosie, your attention to it is really capturing me. And then Paul, with what you said about the idealism of it, it makes me think of my aunt, actually, who spent her entire career working with elder care on different levels, both the individual level and then the systemic kind of policy level.
And she always talks about how elder, you know, for our elders, what the life stage they're at is that stage of meaning making. And so looking back on and did I do this? Did I not do this? And Paul and Rosie, what you're saying really makes me picture the character of David at this moment as an old man speaking this oracle. And I wonder what the tone was with which he spoke it. Is it with a tone of stout courage and confidence that this is the case? Or is it with a tone of question? You know, was my house like this with God? Is this a true question in some sense? Even if grammatically it's formed as a, is not my house like this with God? You know, I think of an older man that I worked with when I was working as a chaplain in a nursing home, and he was preparing for surgery, and he was a stout, he was an old Irishman. And so he still had a little bit of that lilt to him. And it was a really lovely to have conversation with him. And he was stout atheist, very smart person, but was having this kind of moment of quiet crisis when I was in there. And he just said, you know, it makes me wonder what the poet meant when he said, I hope to meet my maker face to face when I have crossed the bar. Was it a hope of hope or a hope of doubt? And he kind of just left it there and then all of a sudden changed the subject. So it makes me really wonder, you know, about the meaning making that's happening here. And are we called to a certain kind of meaning making as well?
I resonate with the kind of ambiguity that's in this poem, which you are highlighting. And Paul was also bringing this out of David's own legacy is so complex, especially in the Samuel presentation, right? And you're right, Rachel. It is phrased as a rhetorical question, like God has made my house, you know, this wonderful thing. But there's some open-endedness there, especially since it goes on to show like good leadership has this sort of outcome, and evildoers in this context, like evil rulers, evil leaders, have this sort of outcome. And we see elements of both in David's own legacy, right? And so it's, even though it's framed as a kind of two paths, either or sort of thing, we can see both elements in David's own legacy.
The thing that I'm stuck on was Rachel's point there on whether that question is a real question, right? I'm looking again at John 18, right? Because the question that I got stuck on is the last one that Pilate asked Jesus, right? So in our translation, it's, so you are a king, ? And I looked at it and I was like, something's off there. So I looked at the Greek and it's a much more ambiguous question in the Greek too, right? So it could be that Pilate is saying in the Greek, therefore then you are a king, right? So it, like more of a statement, because Jesus has just said, my kingdom doesn't belong to this world. If my kingdom belonged to this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here, right? Indeed. And in our translation, Pilate asks him, so you're a king, ? But in the Greek, it's a much more ambiguous statement that's being said. And then Jesus answered, you say that I'm a king. Right. And it's so much ambiguity in this conversation between Pilate and Jesus as they dance around meaning, right? And meaning making in these last moments. Pilate's rule and his authority, you know, is that what kingship looks like? Is this the, you know, kind of, is this how power is held in the world? And Jesus keeps kind of, you know, working this question of truth, you know, whoever belongs to the truth listens to my voice. And I'm like, I'm listening to your voice and I don't understand what you're saying. I feel like so meaning making seems like a really rich way to also approach these, you know, larger, you know, textual questions that are ? But also, you know, broadly, you know, how do we make meaning out of these texts when they themselves are ambiguous? Like, no matter, you know, we're all on some level linguistic experts. And we can't come up with where the punctuation fits there, right? I mean.
So much there. I mean, the part of what makes that scene between Jesus and Pilate so charged is that Pilate's asking those questions, not just as like representing us, the reader, like voicing for us or like for the common person. Like Pilate himself is a leader vested with great authority and power in the moment. And so you have this sort of tense clash between one representative of power and authority and another hashing out what it means for Jesus to be there under arrest as a political criminal.
Yeah.
And what that says about what it means to be a king, which is pretty tense in that moment there. And you're right about the ambiguity, even in the language. Just, you know, a little side note about the language back in 2 Samuel 23. The Hebrew there is pretty complex.
Yeah.
It's not the easiest. The JPS or one of those has a footnote that says at the top, there's like a little footnote and the bottom just says, most of this poem, the Hebrew is uncertain. Like the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain. I was like, okay.
We don't know.
No.
So there's a lot of divergence. Translations handle that poem of David's last words. Even on a linguistic level, there's some ambiguity there. There's a bunch of like Aramaic borrowings and weird stuff like that. So. One other thing I have about just leadership coming from 2 Samuel 23 here, I sort of was having fun with just following the poetry of the poem itself. Mm-hmm. So there's this this extended metaphor that's raised about godly leadership being like sunrise on a morning after the rain, and just sort of a beautiful image, right? But it kind of continues on, and later on in verse 5, will God not cause to prosper all my help and my desire? The word prosper there is yatzmiach, blossom, sprout. So it's like as the sun of godly leadership shines on the prepared ground, it causes life to sprout up. And I thought that was an interesting metaphor to press out, because, you know, for all of the complexity of David's leadership, I think there is something quite truthful there, that good leadership leads to the flourishing of those who are led. And, you know, on the other hand, bad leadership causes destruction. And we see that the next line talks about the godless being like thorns. So here we have another agricultural metaphor here. I'm part of the same metaphor. You've got the good growth and flourishing that sprouts up, but also, you know, choking in thorns. And those are what get put aside and burned. I wonder if Jesus had this poem in mind when earlier in the Gospel of John, he's talking about, I'm the vine, you are the branches.
Look at you pulling, you're pulling Rosie's move here, going to John.
It's the exact same metaphor. Good, the ones who are tied into Jesus's leadership sprout fruit, right? Good growth. And the ones who don't, the bad branches that are gathered up and tossed into the fire, which is exactly what this says. The ones that are like thorns are gathered up and thrown into the fire.
And if we're talking about last words, those are really, I mean, those are the ones that he expects are listening, right? That's the last discourse of Jesus.
So this is also a week where we're thinking about leadership on a kind of, statewide, national level. And I can't help but read a reflection on the consequences of leadership that is focused on justice and ruling in the fear of God, which to me, I read that phrase as being like ruling with a sense of accountability to a greater authority, in the fear of God, that can lead to flourishing community, whereas ignoring that leads to destruction. And I feel that very viscerally this week as we think about the future leadership of our own nation and what the consequences for godly versus ungodly leadership could be for generations.
I mean, I think just to really name explicitly the elephant in the room here, you know, we are
less than a, at the time of recording, we're less than a week after the presidential election in which President-elect Trump won out over Kamala Harris. And for us, that's heavy on our minds and hearts for several reasons. Mm-hmm. For you preachers, it's got to be heavy on your minds and hearts right now because you're preaching into congregations, which probably include a whole spectrum of people who are in experiencing a whole spectrum of emotions. And when you get to Christ the King Sunday or the Reign of Christ Sunday, it's real hard not to talk about the recent presidential election, no matter how sick you might be of thinking, talking, dealing with politics. That's where I went as I was prepping for this text. I think that both John with the interaction with Pilate, David with an oracle of God, a moment of God, even the Daniel text, they really center around the question of where true power and authority lie. Where is power? Where is true authority? What is truth? And I think that that is a question which might feel intimidating. I don't know, quite honestly, if I would have had the guts to take it up at this moment when I was serving as a preacher. But for gutsy preachers, I might recommend it. And this is actually, I'm going to do something I don't think I've ever done before here on First Reading, but this is going to be the one time, perhaps the one time only, where I would actually strongly recommend leaning into the New Testament readings to help us think through this Second Samuel reading. I know.
With her microphone. Don't let her say it.
Yay.
Go with me here. Welcome to Second Reading.
But okay, let me not abandon what we do completely. I'm going to go to historical context to help us make my point. So 2 Samuel 23, most likely written at a time when the kingdom of Israel was still a reality of some sort, or at least written in light of that reality. It's celebrating the man who would go on to become Israel's greatest king, though his history, as we have said, and not only today, but many times before, was fraught and tarnished. In some ways, in that way, 2 Samuel's context kind of matches the U.S. context. We live as a power. Mm. We exist under the guise of our own authority. We believe that we can be just rulers operating for the rest of the world, as 2 Samuel says, like the light of the morning, like the sun on a cloudless morning. City on the hill is an often phrase used or a phrase often used to describe the United States. By the time we get to the writing of John, that kind of like glorious vision of our ability to rule with shiny justice was really revealed as the farce that it always is, no matter who's in power. The Davidic line had come crashing down. Empire after empire had crushed Judah before being squashed in turn by the next conquering imperial foe. The truth of history proclaims the fact that empires always fall. And as much as I hope and pray that the United States will maintain its prosperity and integrity and vision, I know what has happened to three millennia of empires. They fall. John's text is written after the pieces of the Davidic kingdom have been scattered, crushed, squelched, and smushed and ground into dust, basically. So if we're talking historical context, 2 Samuel's text is written in the hope that God will ordain a just human ruler. John's text is written from the ashes of that dream. John's text is written in the hope of new life. And I think for no matter who you're preaching to this week, it's so easy after an election to lose hope. If your team lost, and forgive me for making it simplistic, but just for the sake of today, if your team lost, the future looks dark and scary. And the immortal line from Ted Lasso comes, "It's the hope that kills you." If your team won, conversely, it's also easy to lose hope, because why would you have to have hope when the battle has been won? So in either case, hope has been replaced either with despair or with certainty. And I think what these texts for Christ the King Sunday do is they command us, and I really mean command us, to live neither in despair nor in triumph or certainty, but in hope. In John's gospel, it says, Pilate entered the headquarters again, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not from this world. For this I was born." And it's that word. So that word is on the oldest existing piece of New Testament manuscript that we have. It's dated around 100 CE. It's 3.5 inches high by 2 1/3 inches wide. So it's tiny. But that word is on there, for this I was born. And I would invite you preachers to ask, was Jesus born so that one political party could gain power? Was Jesus born so that any empire could maintain its dominance? Was Jesus born so that elected officials could steal our hope, replacing it either with certainty or with despair? And of course, the answer is no. Jesus was born for sinners. Jesus was born so that communities might work for the reconciliation of the world, so that the entire world might be saved through him. In short, Jesus was born for hope. And I don't know if that would resonate in your setting, but if you feel the need to preach on politics in this Sunday, I wonder if hope might be a way in for all of your members.
Hope is a great theme. I mean, it and you don't have to only be in John's gospel for that. We have that, I think, in that image that's in the poem in 2 Samuel 23 of new life sprouting up when the light of godly, just leadership shines on the prepared ground. And just to piggyback off of what Paul was raising earlier, you know, who is the king that fits this description? And those of us who follow Jesus Christ as our king and celebrate that liturgically on this particular Sunday of recognizing his rule and reign in the world can look to a poem like this and say, Jesus fits this job description as one whose leadership, rulership in the world is like a bright sunrise on a cloudless morning, shining on the ground that's ready to sprout up new growth.
Yeah.
And with that, we can turn our attention to where is the new growth? Where do we see the possibility, what sort of hopes sprouts up when we recognize that no person is ultimately our highest authority, but only Jesus
who
makes possibilities where everything seems like there is no possibility.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right to point us to hope, Rachel. I think that's a place where these texts come together.
Well, and ironically enough, since we talked about bringing Revelation in, Revelation is also making this political claim and is saying not only is it Jesus who is our hope, but it is Jesus, the slaughtered lamb, which is not the hope of an empire. In fact, that is the opposite. It is the upending of empire. That's where our hope is.
There is some kind of there's a language of like judgment in the Daniel passage, which is Daniel 7. We didn't talk about that at all. But, you know, there's the ancient one on the throne, in this case, you know, doing some judgment. And it's in the context of like empires ending, right? So all the oppressive empires end. And I think of that as like the thrones that is referred to in the 2 Samuel 23 passage, like you know, unjust rulership will be burned, right? And just rulership will flourish, right? Like, and even in the Revelation passage, if I'm, you know, right and correct, I think that the context also resonates some themes of persecution, right? And oppression. Yeah. And here Jesus is depicted as like the one who has dominion over all things forever and ever. And he is depicted also as the Alpha and the Omega, like the timeless, eternal king, you know, and that to me, like, also resonates the same theme of hope in that the final word about people under empire is not in the hands of empire, but it's in the hands of God. Like, God has the final word, right? And unjust rulership that oppresses people, that persecutes people, will come to an end. It will be burned because the true Alpha and Omega is Christ, is the ancient one on the throne, right? And so for persecuted people, it is hope that death does not have the final say, but indeed the one who has, you know, the firstborn of all death, the one who has been risen from death has the final say, you know? Preach it.
Preach, Brother Asa.
And you know, the hope that you're talking about is not kind of like pie in the sky, sort of escapist.
No.
I mean, just to take the Daniel passage as an example, here we have this vision of God's rescue, beautiful picture of hope there, written in the language of the empire.
Yeah.
Because that's part of the Aramaic section of the Aramaic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not escapist. It's a kind of resistance against empire in that, which I think is also salient for us now. There are preachers in my circles who would not want us to go to hope as a way to not face the pain or struggle of our experience under empire.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the kind of hope that we're describing here as resistance is a kind of call to action to speak out against the thorny evils of unjust leadership, because our highest authority is not that leadership, but is Christ.
Yeah.
And so there's a freedom to be able to speak out because we speak in the fear of the Lord, you know, rather than the fear of any, you know, earthly leader.
Mm. I think that this conversation in so many ways is a really good example of the power that the biblical text can have to speak in a moment, even when you feel like there might be nothing to say. So whether you take this in terms of last words, in terms of meaning making, in terms of fierce, resistant, resilient hope, we pray for you preachers on this Christ the King Sunday, that you may feel the guiding hand of Jesus, the slaughtered one, bringing you to the place where you need to preach the word that needs to be preached in your congregation. So we send our blessings. If you are looking for more blessings, we might recommend our archive on our podcast. If you are looking to communicate something about these blessings, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us at firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and give us a shout out there. Preachers, we thank you for listening. My name is Rachel Wren.
And I'm Rosie Candlethal.
And I'm Paul Esso.
And I'm Reverend Dr. Tim McNinch. But I brought him there one more time. Thank you all for listening or watching us. We wouldn't be able to do this without you all out there. So thank you so much, especially those of you who have been around for 300 episodes, sticking with us. We hope to make many more. Until then, we'll see you later. Have a great week.